It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, so starting out with the passing of someone we all know, Jackie Hudson, this week.
Yeah, very, very sad news. Jackie Hudson, a longtime peace activist in this area who had been on this show a number of times and has been a stalwart at Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action really since the early 90s when she and her partner moved out here from Michigan specifically to be near the nuclear subbase at Bangor. She passed away this week. Now, she had had been in the news a couple of months ago because she had been in jail for a civil disobedience at the nuclear facility in Tennessee at Oak Ridge. She had been in jail at a private prison contracting to the federal government in Irwin County, Georgia, when she fell ill with heart problems, and it took her 3 days to get any medical attention for those heart problems when what she had was at the time symptoms of a heart attack, although that's not what it turned out to be. And then it took her several more days to get before a federal judge and get her released, during which time, again, she was denied any serious medical treatment. Well, those problems never went away, and she passed away at age 76 this week here in Washington State. And so there's a couple things out of this. Number one is really the danger that so many prisoners, especially in an aging prison population, face from the inadequate medical care made available to prisoners, especially in these private prisons and for-profit prisons, where they have all kinds of financial incentive to cut down on costs like medical care to prisoners, and virtually no incentive, since there's no accountability, to actually take care of those prisoners. But above and beyond that, it's really worthwhile remembering the life of Jackie Hudson. Again, a woman who was involved in a couple of different plowshares actions, who spent some serious time in federal prison from an action in Colorado in the early part of last decade, 2002, I believe the action was, and who had spent a lot of time not just witnessing but actively organizing against nuclear weapons. She and her partner are the caretakers, or actually live in the house that's out at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. And that whole community, which, as we'll mention in events, is gathering this weekend for the anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, very much in mourning this week with the passing of Jackie Hudson. And our hearts go out to them and to everyone in the peace community who knew her, because she will be greatly missed.
Yeah, definitely a woman who walked the walk.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
All right.
Sometimes quite literally.
Yes. Okay, let's move on and continue what we were doing last week, which was...
election endorsements, yeah.
From Eat the State.
Last week we did the King County Council and the City Council, Seattle City Council, and if you missed those and want to know who we endorsed for those positions, you can find that information on our website at eatthestate.org.
And also, actually, the archives of the programs are kept for a couple of weeks at kexp.org for people who ever miss a show or are curious about what we've broadcast in past weeks. Just as a reminder, once again, that I'm working for a city council campaign this year for Jackie Hudson's council campaign. She's not going to get if elected, she will not serve. No, Diane Ferguson's city council campaign, and so I'm not going to be doing much in the way of commentary on other races this year. Although I do have some opinions.
I'm sure you'll weigh in a little bit on the school board.
I'll say something maybe generic about the general need to throw all of the school board incumbents out on their ears.
Yes.
How's that for nice neutral, non-committal sort of?
Wow. Hate to see what you'd say if you didn't have the ropes.
If I were pulling back, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's the disclaimer.
So this week we're doing the school board positions. There are four of them that are being contested during these primary elections. We'll start with the school board District 1 position. The incumbent in that race is Peter Meyer. And as Jav said, he voiced the opinion that we should throw out all the incumbents. And
for all the incumbents that are up this year.
That are up this year, yeah. And I just want to point out that I don't pay a whole lot of attention to school board issues. However, it's been really hard, even for someone like me, to miss some of the problems that have been going on in the school district this year, particularly problems with the financial scandals. There are problems with, you know, that led to the firing of Superintendent Maria Goodlow Johnson, problems with math curriculum, and other issues with the closing of the schools. So there have been some major problems going on in the Seattle School District, enough so that folks have a pretty strong pretty large amount of anger against the incumbents on the school board this year. And each of the incumbents has a lot of candidates running against them. In District 1, Sharon Peasley looks like the good candidate here over incumbent Peter Meyer and educational consultant John Cummings. For District 2, Kate Martin looks like she should be the person you should vote for. The incumbent in this race is Sherry Carr. There's a couple of other candidates in that race, too. Mark T. Weber is too much of a worshiper of John Stanford to be any help for folks on the school board. I think it really was this idea that, oh, we'll bring in an outside person to run the school district, you know, because we had such great success with John Stanford that led to the hiring of Maria Goodlow Johnson and some of the fallout from that.
Well, and because the person after Stanford was Olszewski, who was an inside hire, and frankly, that didn't work very well either.
That didn't work well either, yeah. So I think clearly part of the problem is not a lack of candidates from the outside necessarily, but maybe accountability on the school board. In that District 2 race, too, the other two candidates, former principal Terrence J. Minaj and Jack Whelan, who is a faculty member at the UW School of Business, just don't look to me like they're willing to shake things up quite as much as someone like Kate Martin. In District number 3, you have incumbent Harry M. Martin Morris, with two candidates against him and of course the perpetual crank candidate David Blomstrom. The two candidates running against Martin Morris are Michelle Butow. She has the Democratic she has the Democratic endorsements, but she has this kind of almost too slick marketing speak. But I think you should look past that and vote for her. Her other challenger is teacher John Dunn. He might also be a fairly good choice too if you can't get past the kind of spooky marketing language in Michelle Butow's campaign. For districts.
Yeah, and Dunn is actually, I've heard from some folks who pretty strongly mm-hmm. support him as well.
Yeah, so he might also be a good selection too. In District 6, there are two good candidates, former teacher Marty McLaren and angry parent Joy Anderson. So I guess it's really, up to you whether or not you want to hire a teacher for that position or whether you want to go with an angry parent. Me, I'd be willing to vote for Joy Anderson. Marty McLaren, on the other hand, seems to have the experience of schools and work as a teacher and in work in helping to set up curriculum that might be very much needed on the school board. Incumbent Steve Sundquist, he probably, as Jav said, should be outed at all costs. So definitely vote for either Marty McLaren or Joy Anderson. Nick Esparza, the other candidate in that race, doesn't seem to be a serious candidate for the school board. So any thoughts from you, Jav, on any of these candidates?
Well, again, my primary interest in this is the incumbents. And let's remember, this is the slate of people who was elected in 2007, very much backed by the downtown establishment, by the Seattle Times, et cetera, who in turn turned out a number of the reform candidates who were elected in 2003. These are the folks who were supposed to set the district right and run the district like adults, and they have been an unmitigated disaster. So that's one thought. Yeah. Another thought is that it's a very difficult job for anybody to do because the school board position is a part-time position that pays very poorly, that is being asked to run a multi-million dollar a district that you simply cannot oversee at the level of a part-time job. It's a consuming full-time job that does not pay nearly enough, that as a result attracts candidates that are either independently wealthy or retired or have some other source of income, like a spouse that works or something like that. So there's a very limited pool of people who even run for this position in the first place. It's a very thankless position in a lot of ways, because you don't get paid for the amount that you work, because there are so many entrenched problems there, and because you don't have either the power or the time to do the job you need to do. A lot of the problems actually reside with the staff of the school district. The staff are the folks with the institutional history. They're the folks that have all the information, and they've used that power in really unfortunate ways over the past many, many years, which is why you have these entrenched problems that stay there even though the superintendents and the school board members come and go. So what you really are looking for in this election is you are looking for school board members who will be willing to hold the staff accountable, who will be willing to dig and do some research on their own and go the extra mile.
Dig and keep pushing to get the information.
To get the information and to hold people accountable. And that clearly is not the school board that we have now.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
On to ballot measures.
And then on to ballot measures. There are two major ballot measures for residents of the city of Seattle. One is the King County Proposition 1. That's the Veterans and Human Services Levy. That levy is coming up for renewal. It's not going to be a new tax. And our position is that you should vote approved in order to renew that funding for essential services. The other ballot measure is the City of Seattle Referendum 1. You will be voting on Section 6 of Ordinance Number 123542, which is in an agreement between the City Council and the state regarding the Alaskan Way Viaduct Replacement Tunnel. And if that doesn't confuse the heck out of you, I don't know what will.
And that's intentional.
Yes, and that is intentional. A judge helped pro-tunnel advocates decide to limit this initiative to a vote on some wording in a section in one of the agreements that the City Council had signed with the state to try to limit it so that it would not be a referendum on whether the tunnel can go forward or not. Tunnel opponents, on the other hand, say that it is a vote on whether the tunnel can go forward. We recommend that you vote rejected to show your displeasure over the fact that the state is forcing us to build a downtown traffic tunnel right up against the seawall downtown.
And let's be clear about this. The state, which has ultimate authority over the tunnel, because it's a state highway, and the county executive and the existing city council and, you know, really everybody except the mayor in positions of elected leadership in this area have said very clearly that even if the public votes against votes to reject the tunnel in this referendum, it's not going to stop the tunnel. They're going to go ahead anyway. Now, backers have said they will go to court to try and use this vote to try and stop this tunnel, and certainly there's something to be said for the court of public opinion as well. But let's remember that we already voted on a tunnel measure once in 2007, and 70% of Seattle voters in that election voted against the tunnel proposal that was on the table at that time, and they voted against it largely because of the cost. And so what backers do, they came back with a more expensive tunnel proposal.
Yeah. They say it's cheaper. It's not.
So the likely outcome this time is that there's going to be a strong effort, even if the tunnel referendum, even if the tunnel goes down in this referendum, there will be a strong effort to build it anyway. And in fact, construction on the preliminary approach to the south end has started anyway. That said, even if you believe that the tunnel is going to go forward anyway, even if you think that this debate has gone on for far too long, which it has, I think there is value in saying this is a bad idea, and we want to go on record saying that it does not have the support of the public.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for the future, when the tunnel goes into cost overruns and it proves to be leaky and difficult to maintain, and And we start scratching our heads saying, where did all the money go that we were supposed to spend on social services or on other transportation projects? I think it would be worthwhile to be able to point back to this vote and say, hey, we told you so.
And not only that, but when there becomes the inevitable dispute over the inevitable cost overruns, mm-hmm. because there are a number of people in the state legislature
and it will
who
go
have
to
said,
court, I'm sure.
who have said, you know, mm-hmm. Seattle is going to pick up the tab for cost overruns, which is in defiance of all precedents for state highways. You know, you can point to this vote and say this was a decision that was imposed by the state against the will of Seattle voters.
Yeah. And that may have some bearing in court when this issue does come to court.
All right. Let's move on to some election-related news.
Yeah, there was some election-related news, most of it relating to the tunnel. Tunnel opponents this week sued the Washington Department of Transportation to try to get the financial plan for the tunnel released before the vote on August 16th. The question hinges on gas tax revenue. The last time that the Washington Department of Transportation released any statistics on the financing for the tunnel, it was in 2009, back before the economic downturn went into its third and now fourth year. So what tunnel opponents are saying is, well, because gas tax revenue is down, people are driving less, and there is less economic activity going on, maybe then we will see a much bigger gap between what the state is expecting to collect in transportation funding, what they are able to spend on the tunnel, and what the tunnel actually costs. They want to see those numbers before folks ink their ballots. On the other hand, the Seattle Times, which has been a major cheerleader for the tunnel, ran two articles this week in favor of the tunnel. Danny Westneat's opinion column, which they always print in the local news section as if it were local news and not an editorial.
Well, no, it's clearly marked as a column. I don't think that's accurate.
I don't know.
That space has always been used for opinion columns.
That's clear when you read the print edition, but when you read it online, that's not always so clear. And they also ran an opinion piece on the editorial page by Bruce Ramsey. Both of these columnists said essentially the same thing. They had these extremely unpersuasive arguments, and they both came out with both came down to saying essentially the same thing. Westneat, after talking for a long, you know, after using most of the column to enumerate the problems with the tunnel, finally basically said, it may stink, but not as bad as doing nothing. That's his rationale for voting for the tunnel. Bruce Ramsey, on the other hand, he kind of talked around a lot about how, oh, this is, you know, we've debated this for too long, let's get on with it. And in the end, he basically said, quote, it's better than nothing. End quote.
And I love the fact that Ramsey, who is the committed libertarian on the Times editorial board, is for that reason willing to sign off on a huge multi-billion-dollar boondoggle.
Yeah,
of government
financed
spending.
By the government. Yeah.
Yes.
And what I also want to point out is that there are two problems with this argument. It's better than nothing. For one thing, it's the surface alternative is not nothing. It is a viable alternative, which the state started out studying and then eliminated in the final rounds when they were looking at various alternatives because the downtown business community didn't like the idea of a surface-only option. Surface is not nothing. The surface alternative is actually a good plan, but it's a plan that tunnel proponents will not admit actually exists. Secondly, the argument that it's better than nothing is not true. In fact, the tunnel may be much, much worse than nothing. It may turn out to be a big unfinished hole in the ground, a leaky hole, one that in 20 or 30 years may be full of water with global climate change, and it will probably have a huge debt attached to it. I don't consider that better than nothing. So in other election-related news this week, the Seattle Ethics and Election Commission dismissed last week's complaint against the anti-tunnel group after Protect Seattle Now, which is the name of the anti-tunnel group, actually gave them some evidence proving that, yes, their campaign flyer was designed by a graduate student volunteer on his laptop. Meanwhile, the pro-tunnel folks just said, oh, well, we thought it was a problem. I guess it wasn't. They've gone on to raise a total of $418,334 through the end of July to support the tunnel versus only about $84,000 by the anti-tunnel campaign.
All right. Well, sounds like there's lots of money for that, but looking at the federal budget this week is going to negatively impact the food banks?
Yeah, local food banks this week announced that they are losing local food banks and Share, which operates shelters, about 15 shelters in King County, announced this week that they have lost access to $1.2 million in federal funding that they have counted on for the last 20 years to help them manage 15 local shelters and to supply food to local food banks. This is a big problem because this cut came out of nowhere and these groups have not planned to lose that funding. Share's portion of that funding is $44,000. They use that $44,000 every year to purchase bus tickets for homeless folks so that they can actually get to and from the shelters in King County because none of those shelters are in easily accessible places. You have to actually pay to get to them on the bus, and a lot of homeless people don't have the $2.50 or the $2.25 to get to them. So the loss of those bus tickets means that Share will probably have to shut down its 15 homeless shelters in King County. So right now there's not a good funding plan to replace that money, and folks ought to know that and ought to be thinking about that when they make their charitable contributions this year.
All right. Moving on, Rob McKenna.
Yeah, Rob McKenna. Actually, I'd like to talk a little bit about the $80 car tab fee.
Okay.
Yeah, this week Mayor McGinn endorsed the $80 car tab fee for the November ballot, but Gene Godden came up with a proposal for a lower $40 fee. That means, and her proposal I think is kind of interesting because less of it would go to transit, bike, and pedestrian improvements and more would go to street repairs. But nobody's really talked about what's going into the $80 car tab fee. It should raise about $27.2 million. Half of the fee would go to transit. That's about $13.5 million. Less than a quarter would go to street repairs, or about $5 million of the total. So you have to be asking yourself, okay, $13.5 million for what transit in the city of Seattle? Well, the city of Seattle finances one transit project. That's the South Lake Union streetcar. So that $13.5 million would obviously be used mostly to expand the streetcar system at a time when we don't have the money to spend on that.
And when the existing streetcar facility that we have is severely underutilized and has not been a success.
Yeah, and the city has an $800 million backlog of road and bridge repairs, and $5 million is only a tiny amount to put towards that. Godden, on the other hand, wants to put about $10.2 million to road repairs in her proposal. That would cut it to a $40 car tab fee so that about 75% of the fee would go towards road repairs, but still $2 million would go towards the streetcar system. And so the Displacement Coalition and some other groups this week are urging folks to go to the city council, to call up your city council members and say, maybe this is the year we should do nothing. Let the King County Council put the $20 car tab fee on the ballot for Metro Transit, which is an absolutely necessary service that we need, and maybe the city should punt for a year on trying to collect money for transit.
Yeah, particularly because at this point, if the city puts its larger revenue generator on the ballot, it's likely to make it much more difficult for either one to pass, and that would have very, very bad impacts on bus service in this city.
Yes.
Whereas the city is trying to play a game here by saying, oh, we're funding transit without telling you what that transit is. It's not the transit that most people use or will ever use.
Yeah.
All right. Rob McKenna.
No, why don't we move on to the national
debt ceiling. All right.
Let's talk about
the debt ceiling.
Why don't you go ahead, John?
Yeah. As folks have probably heard, Standards & Poor's lowered the U.S. credit rating to AA last night after the debt ceiling deal of this week. And I wanted to talk mostly about that credit rating. So why don't you go ahead and talk about the actual debt ceiling deal first and what it does and does not do.
Well, you can read all the articles you want in the U.S. press about the debt ceiling, and they're not going to make much sense to you. And you're going to have a hard time figuring out what the plan is all about. And they're very confusing. But, I read a really good article in the Financial Times of London that summed it up in pretty much one sentence, and I'm going to read that sentence to you. 2/3 of the planned savings are supposed to happen between 2017 and 2021. Only 1/3 is scheduled for the next 5 years. So all you really need to know is that the plan that passed was a plan to get together 12 congressmen to come up with a plan that Congress may or may not pass by January 15th. And if they don't pass the plan, which they won't, then an automatic trigger goes into effect. But that automatic trigger doesn't enforce cuts until 2013, in which time there's a whole year, additional year in 2012, for Congress to argue and spew hot air and do nothing, and at the end of 2013 to repeal the whole deal, as they probably will do, because Congress, every time it has ever imposed any kind of strictures on what it can do, has always in the end repealed them. So this really was a whole lot of hot air that brought about absolutely nothing, which of course led to Standard & Poor's saying, well, we have a political deadlock in Washington, and so we're downgrading your credit because you guys really came up with nothing.
Yeah, I want to talk about that credit rating drop a little bit. Apparently there have been a number of warnings going on to the Obama administration for months from Standard & Poor's over the accumulating debt. And now this accumulating debt, a function of two things, both primarily of the Republicans doing. One was the unfunded wars and the huge Bush tax cuts that transformed us from a surplus at the end of the Clinton administration to where we are now. And then of course we had the economic downturn in 2007, 2008. And then we have the Republican insistence that in trying to help create a recovery, that we actually not have any revenue increases, in fact cut taxes at a time when you need to have spending in order to stimulate the economy. That kind of dysfunction is what led to the credit rating. But people may remember that Obama put on the table a quote-unquote grand bargain that put Medicare on the table, that put Social Security on the table. That's because they had been warned by Standard & Poor's that their threshold was $4 trillion over the next 10 years. Anything less than that, and they would be looking at downgrading the credit rating. That's what that was about. Given that that was rejected and seen as not possible, Obama actually did pretty well to avoid major cuts that would have hurt a lot of people. But this is the third world. This is what IMF austerity programs are about. And there was a wonderful quote from the official Chinese news agency Xinhua, which is the organ of the government of China, that quote, international supervision over the issue of U.S. dollars should be introduced, and a new stable and secure global reserve currency may also be an option to avert a catastrophe caused by any single country, that being the United States. What this is about now, you have the largest creditor of the United States, that is the Chinese government, saying that the U.S. does not have the capacity to manage its own currency. That is what leads to IMF austerity measures. Welcome to the third world. And the irony of this, of course, is that the Bush and Tea Party irresponsibility, and these are the folks, mind you, who scream about the U.N. and the lack of sovereignty and so forth, they're causing a loss of U.S. sovereignty and the loss of control over our own currency. We no longer make these decisions.
Okay.
Okay.
IRS report.
Oh, yeah. The IRS released statistics on take-home pay versus corporate profits in 2009 and 2010. Well, it turns out that corporate profits accounted for 14% of total national income in 2010. That's the highest percentage ever. The second highest percentage was back in 1942 during the World War II years, when the government placed limits on what workers could earn in order to help companies make a profit during what they assumed to be hard times for companies. In the first quarter of 2011, that percentage has gone up to 14.2%. So corporations are earning record are taking home a record amount of profits. Small businesses, on the other hand, fell to a 17-year low of 7.7% in 2009 and rebounded only a little bit in 2010. Now, employees, folks who take home a salary or wages, they have always in the past earned at least half of the United States' income until 2010, when their portion fell to 49.9%. In the first quarter of 2011, it's down to 49.6%. So those of us who work for a living, we make less than half of the income in this country. And that's something that folks should know.
And we get taxed a lot more heavily than people who don't work for a living.
Particularly major corporations, many of which pay zero tax.
All right, talking with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
The endorsement articles are up. If you mentioned any of our rundown last week and this week about the city council, county council, the school board measures, the referendum, any of that, go look it up. It's at www.eatthestate.org.